What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to lose some pride, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, soil, to be brought down to earth, to bite the dust, to be laid low. In that sense, maybe a humbling can never actually be welcomed in as great. We would never wish for this encounter with mortality on a planetary scale, but here we are. If this is a humbling, then maybe it's about a regrounding, a reconnection in which we are being made to stare into the dark mirror and reflect on the reflection we see staring back at us. Perhaps there's a message in that image. My name's Ed Gillespie, and myself and my co-host Dougald Hine have spent the last 20 years trying to decipher and articulate that message. How will they look in hindsight, these strange times we are living through? Is this a midlife crisis on humanity's road to the Star Trek future, or the point at which that story of the future unraveled and we came to see how much it had left out? What if our current crises are neither an obstacle to be overcome, nor the end of the world, but a necessary humbling? In the early weeks of the coronavirus crisis and the extraordinary rupture of the everyday that it represents, we set out to explore what it means to be humbled.
Well, here we are, Ed. It's episode 3. We talked about mapping lava, trying to get our bearings within the different stories that are being told about this coronavirus crisis that we're in the middle of, and trying to relate that to the longer trajectory that we've been talking about of this great humbling. And then last week we were talking about, you know, whether we can afford an economic recovery. And there are one or two loose ends from that that we might pick up today. But it feels like it's time to have a conversation about the kind of language and images and ways of speaking that are called for. So we jotted down a title for today, Framing a Language of Longing. But before we dive too deep into that, I feel like we started a tradition last week, which is worth carrying on, which is just, you know, to ask each other, what have you been reading that's helped you this week? What's made you think? What's helped you find your bearings?
There's a couple of unpublished things that I've been ploughing my way through. One is a book on eco-anxiety by the British-Australian psychoanalyst Anushka Gross. I'm actually writing the foreword for this. It's going to be launched shortly as an ebook and then published in the autumn. It was supposed to be published in May, but they put that back for obvious reasons. And I think what Anushka's exploring is really interesting in the notion of climate and eco-anxiety. You know, it's sort of crazy not to be anxious, actually, in the times we find ourselves in. You know, our bodies are always hardwired a little bit for this anxiety. That's what the amygdala in the brain is for, creating those adrenal fight or flight type of responses. But as well as that sort of unease, there's actually another meaning of anxiety, which is the eagerness to do something, and to do something in the face of the trauma we're confronted by. And she actually describes it quite usefully, I think, as the trauma of eco-anxiety is actually like a pre-traumatic stress condition rather than a post-traumatic stress disorder, because it's clearly not a disorder, because it's perfectly reasonable to feel a little bit traumatized in the place where we find ourselves. And she then sort of explores this idea of grief as a dynamic process that then takes you to a new place. It's only through the sort of the realistic embracing of the inevitable loss, which also should be seen in the context of the fact that that inevitability of loss, certainly in our personal lives, doesn't make the ephemerality of life any less valuable. You know, we will probably lose most of the things we love. And that really struck a chord with me personally, having lost my father and my brother in the last 4 years, because that grief is a very powerful thing. And actually, sometimes the refusal to let go of things can be a little bit sort of narcissistic in that sort of self-love type of way. It's the denial that the impossible world you wanted to believe in is going. And that sense of grief is very different to the paralysis of despair. It actually can take you to some very positive places. And it struck me when she was exploring this idea of individualism and the sort of fatalistic attitudes that can then emerge from that, pointing out that, you know, sometimes the projection of our inner emotional conflicts onto the planet as a whole is a reflection of the fact that some aspects of our lives are so unfulfilling that they're not actually worth fighting for, which is this sort of resigned fatalism you get in some threads of environmentalism, that, you know, humans are worthless and not worth defending. And it plays into this notion that when people are saying, well, yeah, we must save the planet for our children, you know, whilst their behaviours are doing exactly the opposite and having massive negative impacts. Where this sort of took me was this awareness of the salience of our own mortality and into some of the elements of terror management theory, where, you know, when you show someone a film of someone dying in order to help them have a better mortality salience of their own vulnerability, often it triggers these conscious defenses where people will then question the science around climate change. They'll deny human agency, or they'll put these things too far away. And maybe that's a quite a Western perspective. But equally, it highlights these immortality systems of death denial that we deploy very readily, whether it's shopping, drink, you know, drugs, the cozy illusions or pacifying myths that we tell ourselves. And the antidote to those sort of death denial systems is really the vibrancy of the joy and the laughter and the creativity and imagination and the awe and wonder of the natural world and the empathy we can have with each other, because it's that that leads to what Anoushka beautifully describes, I think, as these ideas of wild generosity, which we see demonstrated by nurses, teachers, doctors, firefighters, all sorts of key workers in the front line of the crisis right now. And also the radical friendliness that is coming through in terms of the community and mutual aid, where we are curious to reconnect with each other. We're finding ingenious ways of doing so. And those ideas of wild generosity and radical friendliness really stuck with me.
Yeah, that's a really strong language. I mean, there's lots that's resonating for me in what you're describing from the work that we did over the years with Dark Mountain. You know, I've often said that for a lot of people, Dark Mountain was a journey to the far side of despair, a journey to the far side of grief. I'm not heavily invested in which language we use to talk about it, but just this sense that the kind of hope worth having is the kind that lies on the far side of going through the realism of loss, as you said, Anoushka calls it.
It's very true. And then as a sort of adjunct to that, that was in looking at Martin Shaw's book, which I think would be published later this year, All Those Barbarians, which is sort of, he describes it as the grimoire of the school of myth. And it really is the kind of the heart and soul of a lot of his storytelling work. And he kicks that off with a brilliant anecdote from Alexander the Great. You know, in the original Gordian knot was this unentangleable, a bit like the coils of ropes that we talked about in mapping lava. But the Gordian knot was this impenetrable knot that you could not unpick. And he who, or she, who could loosen it would rule all of Asia. But rather than disentangle it, you know, Alexander the Great just takes a sword to it and cuts it in half. And Martin says, you know, this is one of those schism moments. But again, reflecting on that, having read Anoushka Gross's book as well, it's this idea of sturdy grief that Martin then starts to explore versus the death grip, you know, and the acknowledgement that none of us gets out of here alive. And currently we seem to be engaged in a narrative of who dies with the most toys wins, which is really probably not a very compelling story. And there's this idea then which Martin starts to extrapolate, which again really connects with me, is this balance between the storytelling of the timeless and the time bound. You know, there are certain narratives which have been with us and serving us for a very long time, and we get so obsessed with the time bound narratives of the immediate moment. And you can see that when we were mapping lava in episode one, that we're obsessed with the return to business as usual or what new angles will come through. And whilst dismissing or neglecting those deeper, truly valuable narratives, which might be more effective.
Well, that is the knot, isn't it? The weaving together of the timeless and the time bound. And Martin was talking about that Alexander the Great story on the podcast that you pointed us to in episode one. And I had a listen to that this week. And what struck me was his saying, you know, this is always presented as this kind of heroic act of cutting the Gordian knot, but that actually maybe it's a very foolish attempt to take the shortcut. I mean, I've been kind of thinking more about the time bound and the timeless, I guess, in what I've been reading this week. One thing that came to my attention that felt really helpful as a kind of follow-on from our conversation last week was a statement from the editors of degrowth.info, which is a website that acts as a kind of gathering place for conversations about this idea of how we make a journey into a degrowth future, into a future that's cut free from that growth assumption that we were talking about. And they want to say really clearly that the virus is not degrowth. The sudden, unplanned and chaotic downscaling of social and economic activity is not what they call degrowth. It is an example of why degrowth is needed, because it reveals things about the fragility of the systems that we've been operating on and the need for another way of organizing things. And it shows that degrowth is possible because it gives us this proof that actually when there is a sense of existential threat, however you define that, then rapid collective action or rapid semi-disorganized action, but effectively taking place simultaneously around the world, can happen within weeks rather than decades. The thing that struck me was among the reasons why this isn't degrowth. They say degrowth must be intentional and democratic, whereas this crisis has so far disproportionately affected the most vulnerable. And that feels, you know, there's something there that's really important to bring to the fore. John Harris had a great piece in The Guardian this week talking about what the reality of lockdown is like for millions of people and how far away it is from, you know, the situation of actually people like you and me, Ed, who can easily work from home, who to varying degrees might be having what John calls the Sunday supplement version of lockdown, where you're doing all these projects that you've meant to get around to for years with the kids and so on. You know, hunger and not being able to hold things together and incredible stress is the reality of lockdown for millions of people. That feels important to acknowledge because it could be missing from some of the stories we've been telling. But there is another side to that degrowth.info statement that struck me, which is at some level, the kind of radical change which degrowth is about only ever comes out of moments of crisis. And I'm not sure that you can, I'm not sure this is what they're doing, but there was an edge of it to that statement. Say, well, this isn't fair enough and planned enough and chosen enough.
And I know exactly what you mean. I think, and that's why I think the Gordian knot narrative is quite useful here, because that degrowth knot is not being, you know, carefully unpicked by design. It's been hacked by disaster. You know, it's literally been slashed through by events, and we're not disentangling it. We're not creating the safety nets for the immediate and the most vulnerable. You know, we have literally, or the coronavirus has gone at the Gordian knot of economic growth or degrowth,
right,
with a sword.
Right. And that's where no one could wish for this. That's in, you know, the words you wrote to introduce the first episode. No one could wish for this moment, but it is where we are. And so, you know, reading that degrowth statement sent me back to a fascinating text that I was sent a few weeks ago by Michel Bauens, who's the kind of founder and heart of the P2P Foundation, looking at peer-to-peer and commoning approaches to society and the economy and the future. And he, together with Jose Ramos, has written this text called The Pulsation of the Commons, The Temporal Context for the Cosmo-Local Transition, which is quite a mouthful. And it's quite
a mouthful indeed.
But it's really rich pulling together of some stuff that they're planning to explore over the next few years. And it introduced me to a bunch of thinkers who I didn't know anything about. And there's one of them, a guy called Peter Pogani, who was a Hungarian-American thinker who wrote about world history as a pulsation between stable systems and chaotic transitions. So Bauens is kind of summing up Pagani. He says, societies change through chaotic phase transitions in which the old binding elements start disintegrating and new seed forms pre-configuring potential futures start competing in a Darwinian explosion. And I guess that was the thing that was ringing in my head as I read that degrowth statement. It's like, these are the conditions under which change happens. It's messy. It's actually always going to be sudden, unplanned, and chaotic. And if there is any path to degrowth, and I, you know, whatever you call it, whether degrowth is the right name for it is another question that we'll come back to in a minute. But I think it is going to look something like this.
That really resonates with me, what you're saying in terms of the sort of Pagani's perspective on the Darwinian evolutionary aspects of this, because with my, you know, former career as a marine biologist hat on, I can see lots of evolutionary parallels in that context of a social historical process. I mean, in evolutionary biologists would describe evolution as not being, the technical term is phyletic gradualism, you know, where you see these smooth changes over time, you know, as one species gradually diversifies and speciates into multiple species. It's actually much more like what they call punctuated equilibria, where you get long periods of stability and then huge changes, mass extinction events, sudden lurches, whole chaotic eras where, you know, a lot of life can die. If you look back at some of the big extinction events in geological time, you see, you know, whole swathes of life on Earth removed. And, you know, not least the mammalian evolution, which came from the demise of the dinosaurs, which brought us into being here. So I think there's something which really connects with me there in terms of that fact that, you know, our social historical evolution is likely to be through these punctuated equilibria, not gradual, controlled, phyletic processes. And I think there's something here, actually, when bringing in a sort of sensory element, because, you know, we always like to overthink these things, don't we? We can get very into our dogma. But I've been really connecting with the idea that we have to sort of believe our eyes and perhaps our noses in the context in which we find ourselves. You know, we've already seen a report from Harvard University last week, which sort of shows that the decline in air pollution may make it harder for the coronavirus to propagate. It looks like actually the adherence of the virus to air pollutant particulates could actually make transmission easier. But it's really the clean air over cities, you know, the reappearance of the Himalayan mountain skyline over cities in northern India for the first time in decades. I've noticed it in terms of the Brixton bird life on my own roof. And I think that's a combination here of, you know, the fact I can hear the bird song because the traffic is reduced. And perhaps those birds have always been there, but it's also I've had my time and inclination. I've had the ability to pay attention and appreciate that. And I'm sure there's both factors there. It's like the time and space for me to be present, and also the rapid rewilding and the sort of slightly lustier bird song, which seems to come from those animals. And I think that can't be unseen.
There's these very vivid visual memes of this going around, the kind of before and after images of cities around the world, you know. And then we get to also the kind of, you know, the Venetian dolphins, yeah, which turn out to be fake. But you said something really interesting to me the other day about, you know, what lies behind that.
And the reason the Venetian dolphin story went so viral globally, I think, was because it encapsulated a longing that makes us want to believe that that is possible, that they are there. We have actually had whales in the Straits of Messina between the southern tip of Italy and Sicily, but it was this idea that actually we really wanted that to be possible. We wanted that to be there. And so I think part of our challenge now is, how do we speak to and draw on that longing, which is to say, which our eyes and our other senses are not deceiving us. There is a bounce back of wildlife. There is a rapid rewilding. There is a greater presence of nature in our lives. But, you know, it can't just be seen as a temporary blip. There's another article I read which sort of by an American guy called Giulio Vincent Gambuto, who said, we've got to prepare for the ultimate gaslighting. You know, and gaslighting is when you manipulate things to try and get people to doubt their own sanity. And in the article, he said, you know, we're about to be subjected to a massive return to normal advertising campaign, you know, where every brand and business is going to be offering products that are fixing our problems, that offer the solutions that will make us, take us back to the, you know, the happiness, the success, the feeling specialness that we had in our supposed previous lives and era. And that will run roughshod over the idea of this as a great pause. And it will also probably try and convince us that we didn't see this, you know, that we didn't see that bounce back of nature. And also we didn't see the horror of, you know, people dying. It'll try and paper over a lot of these things and return us back into that sense of normality. And so I think somehow we have to celebrate the longing that is being met whilst preparing ourselves for this ultimate gaslighting.
Well, it's like there's a clue there, maybe. A clue to what a language that was strong enough to resist that pull of the back to normal might look like. And that took me to a comment we had from a listener, Jana Krum, here in Sweden, where she was reflecting on some of the language and the framings that we were working with. And she said, you know, what is progress, growth, and development? Is de-progress, de-growth, and de-development our future? And what hit me with that was, you know, the language of D isn't strong enough, is it? You know, we need other ways of talking. And this is, you know, we have to walk this line because there is so much pressure in the worlds that you and I have been part of to tell a positive story, to give people hope. And I don't mean the kind of hope that lies on the far side of despair. I mean the kind of hope that serves as a kind of glorified wishful thinking, so you don't think about the stuff that scares you, that comes back to you quietly in the middle of the night. And I feel like so much of the work that I've been doing over the years has been about trying to find the language that walks that line, that has the realism. I mean, Stephen Jenkinson talks about this. He says, you should seek to be neither hopeful nor hopeless, but hope-free. And that's one way of gesturing towards the kind of strange position that is called for. But I thought this conversation about language and about, you know, a language of longing might be a chance to introduce one of the thinkers who feels like a key reference point for me in the larger conversation about what it means to live in a time of humbling, that you and I are kind of slowly threading our way into here. And this is a guy called Ivan Illich. There's so much that I could say about Illich. There's really nobody who's been more formative for my thinking. In the 70s, you know, for a time, he was a kind of intellectual superstar. I used to say the closest contemporary comparison might be Slavoj Žižek. These days, I fear that it might be sort of Jordan Peterson. But we're talking about another world, and that comparison does not do Illich justice. He had been a Catholic priest. He'd been running this kind of center that morphed into a kind of international think tank in Mexico called the Center for Intercultural Documentation. And then he, you know, fell out with the Vatican hierarchy and had a lot of enemies within the church and sort of walked away from that formal role and wrote this set of books through the 70s that were a critique of the counterproductivity of industrial society, and very much coming from this Mexican context. I mean, Illich himself was part Austrian, part Croatian. His mother was Jewish, and he had kind of grown up with one foot in a village world in rural Croatia in the 1920s and 30s, and then found himself in adult life in Mexico, again, in a context of living closely with village and indigenous life, as well as the kind of urban international networks that he was part of. And this shaped this set of words and framings that were really important to him. And he used to talk about and write about conviviality, and literally meaning living together, coming alive together. And his critiques of industrial society, he was very clear. He didn't want to go back to anything, but he wanted to give us words and concepts with which to have a conversation about the limits we might want to put on the tools and technologies and systems that we have available to us now, in order that we might have a flourishing of conviviality. And there's one image that comes to mind to me that is a good way of just grasping some of what he's gesturing towards there. In the first decade of the 20th century, various people in different cities around the world had the same idea, which was to put this new technology, the film camera, on the front of something else that was quite new, which was the streetcar or tram, and sort of film a journey from one side of a city to the other from the front of the tram. And the footage that's kind of best known to us comes from San Francisco in 1905, a year before the great earthquake and fire that we were talking about last week in relation to Rebecca Solnit's book. And it was used by the musicians Air for the video for their song La Femme d'Argent. And you just get this sort of 7.5 minutes traveling down Market Street in San Francisco. And when you watch it, it's quite hard to believe that this thing isn't choreographed, because you have this kind of Gordian knot, this interweaving of life in the street. And there are cars, automobiles, there's the streetcar, there are horse-drawn carts, there are children playing games in the street, there are people crossing backwards and forwards, and it's all interwoven with this complexity. And what Illich would probably say is that the speed of the way that we then developed those transport technologies cut like the sword through the Gordian knot, through the richness and complexity of the ways of being in and using the street. The street is a place where people hang out and meet each other and play games. And, you know, I saw this happening in Xinjiang, in the far west of China, in the first decade of this century. I spent 6 months living there. And while I was there, you could literally witness the transformation of the streets as more cars began to arrive, more private cars, and as these side streets stopped being places where old men sat out and played chess with each other at tables in the street, and where the cars had to slowly navigate their way through the inhabitation of the street, and began becoming transformed into, you know, channels within a system for ferrying people from place to place. And that's what Illich is trying to say, is that beyond a certain threshold, these amazing technologies that have brought lots of good things become counterproductive. And beyond a certain point, he would say, our schooling systems make us stupider. Our health systems make us sick. Our prison systems create criminality. The last of those is maybe the most obvious one. So when we're talking about this language of longing, this need for words that are richer and, you know, speak to parts of us, speak to our appetites in ways that degrowth is never going to, then conviviality, with its overtones of, you know, the hospitality of the group of people gathered around a table sharing a meal and a bottle of good cheap wine together, you know, that's one of the places I'd be interested in going.
Oh, no, completely. I mean, I'm just loving the imagery of what you were describing there. It took me straight back to Ziga Vertov and Man with a Movie Camera, you know, doing the same thing in Russia and in Moscow at the turn of the 20th century. And also, you know, that idea of road junctions, you've probably seen that incredible footage. I think it's in Addis Ababa. It's an overview camera of a busy road junction, which is completely devoid of any type of signalling or control. And it's exactly the same thing. It's this incredible flow of traffic, but it's all been defined by awareness of what is going on around you. So whilst you have cars and handcarts and pedestrians, there is an incredible organic flow going through it. And actually, there's an interesting example which has just occurred as well in Amsterdam, where on Alexanderplein, I think, they've actually removed all traffic signalling, and they've actually liberated all of the different road users in the idea that this will be the most respectful way to run the particular junction. So it relies on people to be completely awareness of what's going on around them.
I guess what Illich was getting at was that just as we are capable of a rich and subtle and autonomous interweaving of our lives when traffic doesn't go faster than a certain speed in the street, something very similar applies to all sorts of other domains of human activity. And once you're living in a world that is characterized by speed and its equivalents, it becomes hard to even imagine that human beings are capable of living with that degree of autonomy and human complexity as opposed to systemic complexity.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, I used to say this a lot in my slow travel writings, you know, using the Gandhi quote, there was more to life than increasing its speed. And I think there's something in the language here as well, where we always think it's, you know, bigger, better, faster, more. All those words can be positive in one sense, but then become a little bit nightmarish when taken to their logical conclusion. And I'm interested in how, you know, you would see Illich's commentary on the language of nature in the context of the economy. So, you know, does nature do degrowth, or is it something around more like a sort of dynamic equilibrium, which is about joyous exchange, not dominated, skewed or manipulated or even overrun by one particular element or one particular ideology?
Well, I guess what Illich would want to draw our attention to within the economy is the role of other types of activity than the production of commodities, and the sense that we might have got things out of balance between those things that do get produced as commodities and pass through markets and along supply chains and so on, and those things that we are capable of doing for ourselves and for each other at the scale at which we live. So in his later writings, he talked about the vernacular, not just the kind of everyday language as opposed to formal language, but also, you know, everyday skills and capacities for building our own homes, for looking after each other's health, for learning and teaching and passing on knowledge. And I mean, you mentioned to me this book that you've been reading by Julia Watson, which sounds like it's very much in the same territory of the vernacular.
Yeah, it's an utterly beautiful book. It's called Low Tech, TEK, Designed by Radical Indigenism. And it plays to this notion, I think, of both conviviality that you're describing and the idea of resilience. What it is a movement of indigenous philosophy of vernacular architecture, which is all about sustainable and, if you like, climate resilient infrastructure, which I think, as you said in the previous episode, you know, infrastructure is that which is always unappreciated until it disappears or fails to function. And what Julia Watson seems to be sort of tackling head on is this mythology of technology post-enlightenment that was often very dismissive of local wisdom and indigenous innovation as somehow primitive or overly simplistic, where in actual fact, what we are perhaps appreciating now is the fact that there was an incredibly sophisticated aspect to it, and that the elegance of that simplicity is something that we've obviously neglected.
There's a kind of dynamic of brutal simplification that is part of how the world we inherited was created. A motorway is far more simple than that San Francisco street in 1905, just as a rubber plantation is far more simple than any naturally occurring ecosystem. We have to be careful of the mythologizing of the complexity of modern societies, I think.
And that's an absolutely fantastic point. I totally agree. I mean, but the examples Julia Watson uses, which are really quite illustrative, are things like the Khasis root bridges in India, you know, where villages weave these rubber fig trees across the rivers, which make them incredibly resilient to flooding. You know, these beautiful, enduring and durable structures, which are kind of like artworks in themselves, but also happen to be very resilient, given the kind of the flood waters that come through the monsoon seasons. All the way through to things like the Quant underground aqueducts in Iran, which, you know, in contrast to Roman viaducts, which are like the Pont du Gard in the south of France, you know, which are obviously very visible triumphs of engineering for moving water. But in Iran, these aqueducts were dug underground, you know, 2000 years ago. And what's extraordinary about these is 170,000 kilometers of them, which bring water from the mountains to cities like Tehran. And they were just extraordinarily ingenious and innovative solutions, which worked with the grain of nature, with relatively simple technologies, but without the sort of destructive, unconvivial ripple effects and after effects that we might find problematic today.
One of the things that's coming to mind for me as I'm listening to you talking about Watson's book is actually some other people who've been listening to the podcast. I mean, firstly, there's a phrase that comes from the work of Vanessa Andreotti and the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures collective that she's a part of. And they talk about this work of, on the one hand, hospicing modernity, and on the other hand, assisting with the birth of something new, undefined, and potentially, but not necessarily, wiser. And I love the humbleness of that language for a naming of what might be, in the best case, arising out of the kind of moment that we're in. And then there was a lovely post from Jay Cousins in Dahab in Egypt, who was kind of riffing on some of the things we'd been talking about. And he's talking about this narrative of upcycling the system, looking both amongst the rubble and the not yet fallen towers, and taking what it needs to leverage a kinder future. I love that idea of a kinder future. And to me, in the same way as trusting the longing that we were talking about earlier, you know, having the courage to speak a language of kindness is part of where the strength that is needed to navigate all of this comes from for me. And Jay's reflections on, you know, upcycling the system and looking among the rubble took me back to Michel Bowens and to Pagani, the Hungarian-American guy who he was quoting, because within that there's an idea that one of the things that might happen as we roll through periods of unraveling is that we stabilize at a new level. And when I say at a new level, not, you know, ascending to some higher, previously unseen level of collective consciousness, not going back to any pre-existing state because that's not available either, but potentially a humbler level based on a way of approaching the world that's not characterized by the degree of speed and exploitation and extraction that has characterized the world, the civilization that is now in crisis. As Vanessa would say, it's sort of reaching for as yet unimaginable futures. And it feels like that's kind of what we're in the business of trying to weave together in these conversations.
Oh, completely, completely. I think, as you say, is the as yet unimaginable futures. I think one of our first discussions flushed out this idea that one of the challenges we've had is over 20 years is trying to articulate this story and these ideas in a way which is compelling and engaging to people, or the way that, you know, Dr. Martin Shaw would describe as a wild way of telling the truth, which is the way he brings his myth to the table. And I think it's so easy to be sucked back into that economy speak, as we almost were in episode two. But the real courageous challenge is to try and stay true to the articulations that, that touch a different part of us, that touch the heart. As you say, the kind of the kindness and the wild generosity and the radical friendliness that we were talking about earlier in the episode, and the conviviality that Illich brings. And I think that's maybe the difference between what Anoushka Gross calls solastalgia, which is finding discomfort where you used to find comfort. And that comes from the Latin solacium for comfort and Greek for alger, pain. The difference between that, because obviously where we used to find comfort, we may be finding discomfort now in terms of the ability to let go of a world that has been turned on its head. And Joanna Macy's radical hope, which, as you say, is that hope beyond a place of despair, and where actually the real work is happening.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. These are astonishing times to be living in, times in which many things are revealed, uncovered, brought into a new light. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription, a provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with, and needs a little time and space to breathe. This is an unscripted conversation, a wandering, if you will. And as Tolkien said, not all those who wander are lost. We plan this as a series of informal and roving conversations as we all adventure into uncharted internal and external territories. For us, daring to dream beyond the current urgency does not dismiss or disrespect it. Rather, it honours it. Whether we like it or not, our futures are already being decided today. Please do comment, ask questions and respond. You can find us on Facebook at The Great Humbling. This is initiation at a cultural scale. Please come and join us on this emergent journey.